The Chief Executioners of France, the Sanson Family. Executions between the years 1840 and 1847. Now, Henri Clément Sanson received orders for 18 executions during this time period, which is astonishingly low in view of the activity of the preceding decades and an indication that the courts had begun to listen to opinions of men such as Benjamin Appert, to words such as reform, security from arbitrary arrest, and equality of justice. Like his ancestors, Henri Clément was a pariah, but unlike them, he became a curiosity. The isolation imposed on the earlier Sanson was denied the last male member of the family. Men with a genuine interest in reform sought him out for purposes of research and education. And because these men bore distinguished and famous names, a great many lesser men and women had to emulate them. It became fashionable, a la mode, to be able to announce at a dinner table, "I have seen and talked with Sanson," or "I witnessed a demonstration of the guillotine." It is not unlikely that these constant reminders of his function in life added to Henri Clément's misery. For while it may be flattering to have a stream of visitors ring the doorbell, it is scarcely soothing to the ego to know that one is the object of morbid curiosity rather than admiration. In some ways, the guillotine's shadow clung to Henri Clément's coattail more persistently than it had to any of his predecessors, for they were accepted as a necessary evil, whereas Henri Clément was not, and perhaps not even necessary. The executioner's morale sank lower and lower, despite the infrequency of his visits to the scaffold. To bolster it, he spent more and more time in gambling houses, bought more expensive paintings and furniture for his house, and lavished more presents on women until one day he awakened to the fact that his debts exceeded his ability to pay. Then he began pawning objects to art and family possessions in order to pay his creditors. But by this time, there were too many creditors, too much a gap between what he could realize and what he owed. The threat of Clichy, the prison of debtors, so named because of its location in the Rue de Clichy, had become an actual reality. Paris prisons, such as the Concierge, La Force, Sainte-Pélagie, the Luxembourg, the Châtelet, almost 80 of them existed during the Revolution, varied both as to the character of those imprisoned and the accommodation given them. The Concierge, situated near the Seine, was known to be the worst. Bellu, editor of the Courrier Français, who was incarcerated as an alleged suspect, described it as the most horrible and pernicious of all. One waited for a room with a bed for as long as 15 days. One paid 18 francs a month for such accommodations. When the river was high, it reached the level of the prison floor, and then the humidity pervaded everywhere. Water streamed down every wall. Dukes and princes shared cells with robbers and murderers, slept on pallets of vermin-infested straw, and were treated in the same brutal way, whether sentenced for murder or merely speaking out against the regime. In contrast to Concierge, Clichy housed neither murders nor political prisoners. No disgrace was attached to the term imprisonment for debt. In fact, some of its inmates bore the most distinguished names in France. Clichy offered large, airy, completely furnished rooms, not cells, and the rooms were not only clean and comfortable, but heated. The prison had a library, a post office, and messengers to run errands in Paris for any prisoner who needed such service. Recreation took place in the prison courtyard, where men enjoyed a game of skittles, and women could walk about. Relatives and friends were permitted to visit the unfortunates and to send them food and drink. Unlike ordinary criminals, debtors were escorted to Clichy by men known as recours, process servers, rather than by the gendarmes or the Paris police. The recours were forbidden by law to apprehending a victim outside of Paris, and they had to, and to make their task more difficult, the arrest had to be made between 6 o'clock in the evening and 6 in the morning. As a consequence, men pursued by their creditors made it a habit to leave Paris for one of the suburbs during the daylight hours, sneaking back at twilight to see their loved ones and sleep in their own beds. Henri Clément soon found himself among these fugitives who spent their days drinking, eating, and playing cards in local taverns and cafes, one ear cocked for the striking of the clock that would signal their nightly release. For several months, the Monsieur de Paris managed to elude capture, thanks to the leniency of the courts, which during a fairly lengthy period sent no one to the guillotine. But the day came when Henri Clement received his orders for another execution. Another regicide had been sentenced to death, a man named Lecomte, erstwhile member of the Legion of Honor, chief forester of the royal domain of Fontainebleau, reprimanded and fined for brutality to his subordinates on more than one occasion. He finally resigned his job and claimed a pension. But the forest of Fontainebleau was a private domain which belonged to the king, not to the crown. And as a private employee, Lecomte was not entitled to a pension. The angry Garde General de Forest wrote to Louis-Philippe 3 times without receiving an answer. At last, furious at being abused and mistreated, Lecomte resolved to kill the man. Stationing himself on top of a wall near the chateau, he waited until Louis-Philippe, accompanied by his wife and grandchildren, appeared in the palace driveway in an open carriage. When 2 bursts from his gun failed to hit any of the members of the royal entourage, Lecomte ran into the forest, where he was quickly captured. The chamber of peers debated his case for 5 days. 32 members voted for his death. The 33rd one, Victor Hugo, refused. But it didn't make any difference. Other members of the chamber joined Hugo, but with 229 votes against him, Lecomte was sentenced to death. On June 8, 1846, Henri Clement ascended the scaffold and directed the proceedings, then accompanied the body of the deceased to the cemetery of Clamart before returning to his house on the Rue des Marais. Had he been aware of the process server who dogged his steps throughout the day, he'd have a difficult time avoiding the recurs whose carriage followed his every move. That evening, Henri Clement Sanson was taken to the Clichy prison, where despite his protests, he remained for some time. Then he had an inspiration. He would pawn the guillotine. The instrument was his. Why not use it to pay his debts? Accompanied by the recurs, he was permitted to leave Clichy and go to the Quai de Valmy, where he kept his machine. From there, he took it to his principal creditor, who promised to return it to him when he had paid his debts. That was 3,800 francs. Several months passed, months during which time Henri Clement must have held his breath, for if an order to execute had arrived at his door, he would have been unable to carry it out. Such orders usually came the day before the event, so that the bourreau and his aides would have time to set up the scaffold and make their preparations. On March the 17th, 1847, the papers were delivered, bidding the executioner of the criminal judgment of the city of Paris to present himself at the Palais de Justice at such and such a time. Henri Clement pleaded with his creditor to release the guillotine, even if just for the morning, but he was unsuccessful. Finally, he had to present himself at the Ministry of Justice and confess his predicament. The minister had no choice but to order payment of 3,800 francs to Henri Clement Sanson so that he could redeem his machine. On June the 18th, he guillotined his last victim, and that evening he received his notice of dismissal. The last of the Sansons had come to the end of his career. Now, the sources for this, The Legacy of Death by Levy, The History of Capital Punishment by Scott, The Encyclopedia of Murder by Wilson, Collin, and Pittman, History of the Guillotine by Kirshaw, Sept Generations Executioner, 1688-1847, by Henri Sanson, and Madame Tussaud's Memoirs by Madame Tussaud. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise. And if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.